This is Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. I'm the director of Big River Paranormal, the Oregon team for the Atlantic Paranormal Society. I've been obsessed with the paranormal since having unexplained experiences as a child. These experiences left me with more questions than answers. Join me as we explore all things paranormal with some of the top specialists and experts in the paranormal community. Welcome to Hassling the Paranormal. I'm your host, Jason Hassler. Today's guest is Lon Strickler. How are you doing today, Lon?
I'm doing well.
So let me ask you, what started your interest in the paranormal?
Well, I was, I kind of fell into this whole thing when I was young. I knew something was a little odd about me, but when I really did find out that there was something different going on, one summer day, I used to spend a lot of time on the Gettysburg Battlefield because I used to live very near, and I still live very near there right now. So I'd get on my bike and I'd pedal out there on an afternoon to spend time on the battlefield. That was something I liked to do during the summer when I was younger. Yeah. So I was about 9 years old. It was 1967, I think it was. And I was in the area around the wheat field, Devil's Den, and that area in between there called Valley of Death. And I was on my bike. I stopped for a bit on the bike, and all of a sudden, there was like a huge TV screen opened up in front of me, and I was in the battle. I mean, I was literally hearing gunfire, cannon fire, smelling gunpowder, hearing screaming and yelling, gunshots, the whole nine yards. It was wow. Like I was right there. And that lasted, I estimate, maybe about 30 seconds, and then it just faded away. And that was when I realized that there was something up with me and that I could detect these type of things. I mean, and I had inclinations of that before, but that day kind of really proved it to me. And since then, it's been something I've had all my life. I mean, it's an intuitive ability. I'm a clairsentient as well. Okay. But I was looking into, I started back then when I got into high school, started doing paranormal investigations when it wasn't mainstream at all. I mean, people think you're crazy, but back then, you know, they ask you, you say, well, I'm doing an paranormal investigation or whatever. And of course you didn't have cell phones or anything. So it was kind of word of mouth, but I would literally get jobs as a kid in high school, going to different locations around town and such when I started driving, and actually go into people's homes and businesses and see what I could pick up on. And I did that, and I continued doing that after I moved to Baltimore and lived down there for about 40 years. I kept on doing that. But eventually, well, in 1981, I was living in Sykesville, Maryland, and I had a Bigfoot encounter while I was fishing. And I wanted to know what it was I encountered that day, and that's kind of where my whole interest in cryptids and other parts of the paranormal started at. And it kept going since then, and that's what I've been doing.
How did your friends and family feel about all that?
Well, my parents, I didn't tell them anything. I just kind of kept it as quiet as possible. I never told them what I was sensing and feeling and such. And when I did get married, my first wife knew what I was doing. My second wife, I kind of kept it from her for a bit, but then I started easing her into it. And I started picking back up on it again. And, you know, I was working a regular job as well.
Yeah.
But this was something I was doing kind of on the side. And as years progressed, and I've had a couple encounters and other things going on, and, you know, cases and actually keeping logs of everything, you know, eventually the internet came in the 90s, and I started working on some websites for other folks who had sites about the paranormal, and I would I would write and post my encounters and other things people would get to give to me. Every time I'd go on the road, I'd be collecting encounter reports just here and there. But eventually in 2005, I started Phantoms and Monsters, and I've been doing it ever since.
So you also have a list of books you've written. Do you have a particular favorite book?
Not really. The one in particular, which involved the case was on, was the Mothman Dynasty book about the Chicago winged humanoids.
Okay.
And I kind of put a little more of that in the next book, which was Winged Cryptids. But the second part of the book was all kinds of winged cryptid phenomena as well. So I could actually write a couple more books with this whole thing that happened in the Chicagoland area. But, I've kind of gone on to a few other things. And the last book I wrote about was the Glimmer Man book, which was about the what people want to call the predator effect, or this type of glass scene or semi-invisible humanoids that people continuously see that look very similar to what the Predator looked like in the Predator films when he went into a cloaking. And that book was just released in March. So, kind of the first book that ever got out about that. And it's doing very well. And but that was my 10th book. So I did that with two other gentlemen who I've been investigating this phenomenon with.
Is that something that you're seeing all over the country or the world, or is there a specific area that's happening in?
Well, it's mostly reported in North America, but there have been sightings worldwide. It's bizarre. I mean, we have no idea what it is. I mean, is it ultra-terrestrial, extraterrestrial, or it could be some natural being of some type that has the ability to do something like this? Nonetheless, it's supernatural, regardless of what it is, and so we all we can do is just take the reports and go with it until we get the means to where we can actually investigate it deeper and start getting some answers. But it's just one of many mysteries and fortune phenomena that we just really don't know about.
How do you go about getting people to talk to you about those kinds of things? Because I realize it's not an easy thing to do as a paranormal investigator myself.
Yeah, I guess it's the way you act around people. I literally, when I talk to people on the phone or I'll go to them in person, I listen to them. I give them the benefit of the doubt. They tell me their story. I get as much information as I can out of them. And I go from there. And if I find something different, if I find out they were not being honest with me, I'll usually just go ahead and drop that. Though I will keep a record of them in case I got to come back to it. So I think people appreciate that. I mean, you're giving them the opportunity to come forward. And my thought is that when somebody asks me to come into a case of theirs, I'm part of the case, basically.
Yeah.
And I take it upon myself to make sure that I do the best I can for them, to give them as many answers as I possibly can give them without giving them conjecture or anything. It's just, we just don't really know what's true. But that's the way I conduct. And, you know, over all the years and the thousands of reports and such I've taken, you can kind of get to the point where you know where somebody's pulling the wool over your eyes. So
so
that's how I conduct it, and my team pretty well does the same thing. We let people talk and tell us, but you know, if we get together as a team and decide that there's something not right about that, and I'll always send any case I get, and they do the same to the team itself to get some ideas of what's going on, and we determine what's going to go on from there on.
How often can you find logical explanations for what people have been experiencing?
Logical? I guess it depends what you consider logical. Just for instance, this whole thing has been going on in Chicago. There's no real logic to it. But we do have theories. I mean, I think these beings are ultra-terrestrials. Basically, they are portal travelers of some type. They have the ability to move within either dimensions or realms or whatever. But I think they come from somewhere else. And I honestly think most cryptids do. I think they may not necessarily come from the same place, but I think that as defining them as ultra-terrestrial, they do spend time here, but they do spend time somewhere else. And, there have been witness reports that have kind of bolstered that, especially when somebody will see one of these things literally come through like an invisible doorway and vice versa, just go through something that's invisible and they're gone. The sightings are very fleeting, but it seems to me that these beings want certain people to see them. There have been instances where they would be seen in a large crowd, but one or two people would be the only ones to see it. And that has happened many times. So it's like they have the an ability to distinct who can actually see them.
And you start to figure out if there's a reason some people can see them or and some people not, or why they're allowing certain people to see them?
I don't know. We haven't determined that yet, but I think they do have some type of ability to figure out that, and they act like they do want to be seen. Now, do they want to be reported? We don't know that, but it does seem that they do want to be seen. What their agenda is, why they're doing it, that we don't know. But we take as much information as we possibly can. And in fact, this phenomenon right now, we've got 186 reports that we believe are valid reports over since 2011. And then we've gotten a few reports that happened before that time period. So, but people are coming forward. They're interested. They hear about it. A lot of times they'll contact me and not even know anything about what's been going on. But and one thing that has really made a distinction with this whole phenomenon in Chicago has been that rarely will a witness embellish. In other words, they will not say something other than what they initially told me.
Okay.
And God knows I've tried to get them to do that just to see if they would fall for it, but it just doesn't happen. It seems like they're imprinted with the phenomena, and that's what they saw. That's the story they keep, and they don't try to go beyond that.
So they're seeing like a Mothman-type creature in the Chicago area?
It's the whole Mothman moniker was not my idea. That was Chicago media. I mean, you know, I was calling it the Chicago Phantom because I didn't really know what it was. All I did know was it was humanoid in shape. It had large wings, different types of wings. I mean, anywhere from bat-like to insectoid to owl's wings. It varied early on, especially. But as time went on, it was mostly the bat-winged beings. A good majority of them had the red eyes that actually projected red light. But there have been others that haven't. So, that's pretty well the way we have, been handling this. But, that's basically what we've been reporting. And the whole Mothman thing, I guess the press just wanted to go ahead and parallel along with Point Pleasant sightings. And when they were talking to me, when I was doing drive time radio on Chicago stations, they were calling it the Mothman, and I didn't want to confuse anybody. So I decided, that's what we're going to call it. And that's what we went with.
Do you have a take on the Mothman, the original Mothman stuff?
I do. I do believe, I have done a lot of investigations down in that location, especially around the old West Virginia Ordnance Works where a lot of these sightings took place. And after doing some actual paranormal investigations and EVPs and other type of paranormal work, besides my intuitiveness and some of the other things I am involved with, I do believe that the Mothman and possibly these winged humanoids may be summoned beings. And the reason I say that is just by the energy, particularly at the West Virginia Ordnance Works, that we have picked up through EVPs and other sensing abilities, that it may have been summoned there to protect it. In other words, that area where the old Ordnance Works was, it was a hangout. I mean, a lot of younger people went there and hung out and made out and just parked. And I think the thing felt threatened by it. And it summoned this being from wherever. And it turned into like a protector or a sentinel. And it continued doing that. And honestly, you know, if you look at the original reports, this thing literally chased people out of there. And it was very aggressive. It didn't hurt anybody, but it was very aggressive. And it did act like it was there to protect something.
Is there still currently Mothman sightings in that area, or is it pretty something that's kind of died off?
Oh, it's not as much as it used to be, but I still get reports in Mason County, even over into Ohio as well. I'd say over the last 20 years, I've had reports all up and down the Ohio River Valley, anywhere from Cincinnati up into Pittsburgh. So it continues. Mason County does still have sightings of this creature that people described back in the late 60s. So we occasionally do get a report.
What advice would you give to someone that had an encounter with something like that?
There's not a whole lot you can tell them. I mean, you know, they're going to come forward. If they come forward and tell you they've had the encounter, you just try to get as much information you can. Of course, in any cryptid sighting, and in particular in Chicago as well, people were fearful this thing would come back and either haunt them or attack them or do something, and that's why a lot of them were afraid to talk about it at first. You know, you got to try to calm down those fears, tell them you don't know if that's going to happen, because you really don't. I mean, but, you know, we haven't had anybody experience anything beyond the initial account, but we have had a few.
So Washington State, where I am, has a whole list of reported sightings of various cryptids. You recently did a show on your series of Unexplained States about Washington. So I had to bring you on to discuss some of these. Did you have a particular story there that stood out to you?
Well, the only one that was really related to me was the abduction story in particular. It was probably the last one on the video.
Yeah.
That one hit home, honestly, because it was one of those things where, you know, I had a feeling that something was ramping up, but honestly, I couldn't really do much. I mean, I only had one real conversation with her. And when it got to the point where, you know, where I found out that she had gone missing without any explanation, it really set me for a loop, honestly. I almost got to the point where I was about to quit the whole thing, to be honest with you.
So she called to report sightings and things to you, and then after that she came up missing? Is that?
Yeah. You know, it was July 2009. I received a call from this young school teacher named Mandy, who lived with her mother on an isolated farmhouse in East Central Washington. They were about a half a mile from the Idaho border. And when they did contact me, after contacting an investigator in Spokane, he recommended me to them because I had worked on a few others. And she literally told me, I mean, you know, my life has become a living nightmare. She was terrified of the dark, afraid to leave the house at night. She did believe that something beyond human had targeted her and her mother. And that the activity actually started about 2 weeks prior to calling me. Now, she did start going into the details. Starting, she said her and her mother had earlier noticed a lot of unusual red and white lights hovering over the Coeur d'Alene Mountains, which were east of them in Idaho.
Okay.
And she said that one of the nights after they saw the lights, Mandy experienced a violent dream involving flashing lights and mechanical sounds. And she woke up nauseous and disoriented and really frightened, actually. Her mother just dismissed it as, you know, a nightmare. But then the lights returned. And one evening, while Mandy and her mother were cleaning up after dinner, I think they told me it was about 8 o'clock, they heard a sharp popping sound outside of the farmhouse. And when they looked through the window, they saw hundreds of red and white lights moving rapidly across the sky and over the property. And whenever two of the lights appeared to collide, a loud popping sound echoed through the yard. They could hear it inside. So at the same time, the telephone just stopped working because she went to try to report it and the phone wasn't working at all. And all the house lights started flickering. So then they noticed there were scratching sounds moving across the roof. But then without warning, everything just stopped. So Mandy stepped outside. She detected a faint odor of burnt motor oil, which we never had been able to figure out what that was. But there was no visible evidence explaining what had happened. But the following night was worse. There were heavy thuds on the roof, rapid scampering across the attic. Red and white lights again surrounded the farmhouse. This time, the electricity failed completely and remained off for nearly an hour. Mandy and her mother retreated to a bedroom where they sat together by candlelight. They felt like prisoners in their own home.
I imagine, yeah.
They couldn't use the telephone, and they couldn't see what was moving above them. And they didn't dare go upstairs into the attic. So they didn't know if somebody was attempting to enter the house or what was going on. But that next day is when they contacted me. And I could hear the terror in her voice. I mean, it wasn't exaggerated or rehearsed, or it was sincere, raw and sincere. And she desperately wanted an explanation. And during that conversation, she asked me the question that I've never forgotten. Why is this happening to us? Well, I couldn't really answer that. I instructed both of them to maintain detailed journals and to contact me after every incident. And that night, we spoke late into the night because I was on the East Coast, of course, her being out in the West. But I did believe that they were genuinely frightened and that something seemed to be deliberately targeting them. And I just got that sense that, but that was the last real conversation I ever had with Mandy. Several days later, her mother called me after not contacting me for almost a week. And her voice was broken with grief. You could hear it. And she told me, "I'm sorry we didn't contact you, but there's been a lot going on, and Mandy's missing."
Wow.
And that night after our conversation, the initial conversation with Mandy and her mother, she had gone to bed as usual. At approximately 11 o'clock, her mother noticed a light shining from beneath Mandy's bedroom as she walked upstairs to go to her room. But when she opened the door, the light suddenly went out, and Mandy was nowhere to be found. Now, her car was still there. Her clothes, belongings, personal items hadn't been disturbed. There was no known visitor, no obvious signs of forced entry. There was no explanation for how Mandy could have left the bedroom or the farmhouse without the mother noticing.
Yeah.
So the police investigators reportedly considered the possibility she had left voluntarily or departed with someone during the night. Of course, she was an adult. They couldn't really do much of anything.
Yeah,
for sure. But there was no evidence supporting either explanation. It was as though she had just vanished in thin air. Wow. And as of my last inquiry with the Washington authorities, I mean, her disappearance remains unsolved. And that's been almost 17 years now.
Wow.
And there's never been any confirmed trace of her ever found. I remain convinced that she was taken, though not necessarily by human hands. I think it was something possibly extraterrestrial or, something.
Yeah.
Her disappearance occurred after repeated aerial phenomena, telephone, electrical failures and unexplained sounds in the roof and the attic. And she had physical illness and growing conviction that unknown intelligence had singled them out. And, as investigators, we attempted to document the facts as best we could, identify patterns and separate evidence from speculation. But unfortunately, this deeply affected me as well.
I imagine so, yeah.
And because I felt at the time that I kind of left her down. There was nothing I really could have done, but I just felt that I left her down. She wanted someone to tell her that she wasn't imagining these things and maybe giving some reassurance.
Interesting.
So as time went on, I did find out that her mother had passed away three years after that, not knowing whatever happened to her. The property, everything went into escrow. Then eventually Mandy was declared deceased. But I do check with the Washington State Police occasionally and to see if there's been anything going on. But nothing has occurred. She hasn't showed up anywhere, credit cards, nothing. So we just don't know what happened.
And there was no other like witnesses, any activity in the area or any other missing people?
No, the house itself was pretty far away from any neighbors. I mean, yeah. It was an old farmhouse. There was land around it. I don't know if anybody else experienced anything or not, because I was never contacted and I was never told about any other phenomena. So it does seem that they were targeted specifically.
It's interesting. I wonder, it makes you wonder what about her was the, why she was targeted and that kind of thing.
Well, you hear cases about people having encounters and abductions and such, and that's one of the first things you wonder. Why me? Why them? Why does this happen?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we just don't have that answer. We may at one point, maybe someday it'll come forward that, but at this point now, even 17 years after that happened, we really don't know much of anything. Other than conjecture, speculation, there's lots of theories out there, but beyond that, we just don't really know.
Were the police notified about the activity? And how did they, if so, how did they respond to that kind of thing?
Well, I talked to the police. I told them what had happened.
Yeah.
I don't know how much her mother really told them, and they didn't let on to me what she told them. But it was part of their investigation. I mean, they did an inquiry, but it wasn't, I mean, she was an adult and they really much they could do about it.
Yeah, for sure. That's.
But they did an inquiry and I did give a statement and so it's part of the record and it's still there, but it's just something that we really don't know what to think about it.
Wow. So I wanted to also ask you, in 1980, the story you told about the Mount St. Helens eruption, and the reason it kind of piqued my interest because I'd heard about this before and I'd have asked people about it, and a lot of people said that they didn't know anything about it. But as far as when the eruption happened, the military was seen maybe what people described as escorting Sasquatches or tall beings out of the area.
Yeah. Well. There was more than, from what I understand and from what I've investigated over the years, there was more than one encounter with these beings, either by Canadian forces, because some of these were Canadian forces that came down to help out. I believe there are at least three situations where some aid was given to these creatures. But all I know is what I was told. I mean, there was another particular incident, though. It's kind of a well-known incident, but there's really no meat to it. This encounter that was reported to me later on by this gentleman from California provided more information than most reports that I have heard concerning this, but. I don't even know if it was true, but his demeanor and the way he was telling it to me, it did seem that something very similar to what he witnessed did occur.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time in the Mount St. Helens area and Mount Hood area and with the Mount Adams and all that in the area. And it's really kind of a paranormal hotspot.
Mm-hmm.
There are so many stories about Sasquatch and other things here. We also have the Klickitat Ape Cat. Have you heard about that in the Columbia River Gorge?
The what again?
It's called the Klickitat, which is the area ape cat. So what people described as seeing is this large black, like cougar-like cat, but it has a ape face.
I haven't heard that one. I mean, you know, you hear a lot of stories that come out of Washington and up into British Columbia.
Yeah.
But that one in particular, I do not know about.
Yeah, there's a gentleman named James Shupsky. He has a Margie's Outdoor Store in the Gorge in Bingen, Washington. What he does is he has the outdoor store, and then people come in and they tell him their paranormal sightings and stuff there, and he documents it all and maps it out, and sometimes he investigates and stuff. So yeah, one of the things he's been talked a lot about is the Klickitat ape cat, and I found that to be an interesting story because I mean, like, cougars aren't known to be black in color here, so it probably wouldn't be a identity, but like an ape face really kind of threw me off. Why would it have an ape-like face? But you know, you never know with these cryptid things.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, over the years, I have received so many bizarre sighting reports of all kinds of different things, in particular up in the Pacific Northwest, and you just don't really know what to think. The one thing I do believe is that the Sasquatch, particularly in that region, are probably not interdimensional beings. In other words, they're there. They have family groups. They reproduce. I think they do live on our plane all the time, are indigenous. And I think there are other places where it occurs too, Florida, around the Gulf Coast and such, areas where, you know, there have been family reports of families and groups of these beings. But everywhere else, even though it's possible that there could be indigenous groups or individuals, for the most part, I just don't believe it. I think most cryptids in particular are some type of supernatural being.
Which makes it even harder to prove.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, we have a lot of Sasquatch stories here. Have you heard of the Ape Canyon story?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, a friend of mine, Mark Marcel, he has a documentary on that. What he did was, he thought it was a really cool story, but without evidence, that's all it was.
Right.
So he's a land surveyor for his job. So he did all the digging and information, trying to figure out where this possible cabin was for these people that were the mining. And they told him that they believe that area was spared in the eruption. So he went up there years and years looking, and he did find the cabin site.
Hmm.
And they did a documentary about it last year. It's called Siege of Ape Canyon. It's pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hadn't seen it, but I did know about the documentary.
Yeah.
I've heard stories about that for years and years, and it seems like everybody wants to put their take in it, but sure. But from what I have, read about and looked into, it's the standard story. The story that most people go by seems to be what had happened. I believe something happened.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily believe everything that was talked about or put into the account actually happened. You know, when you read the old newspaper accounts from back in the 19th century, the embellishment is pretty rampant. And, they kind of like to make generalizations as to what had happened as opposed to what somebody told them had happened or what,
So long ago, yeah.
Yeah. It does usually get a little spicier as time goes on.
Yeah, some definitely scared them for them to leave their site and not return, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, if it was a claim, I mean, and then for them to leave a claim, I think something definitely happened.
Yeah. So have you done Oregon yet or just Washington?
I haven't done Oregon yet, and I will do that. And, I'm kind of done maybe 10 or 11 states at this point. Yeah. I'm probably going to get every one of them because I've got enough reports to handle that. And I may start doing more on the same states again, because I do have other stories. I mean, and me being here in Pennsylvania, we've got a lot of Pennsylvania, Maryland, and and New Jersey and West Virginia stories. So it'll keep me busy for a while. It seemed to be popular, so I'm going to continue with it.
Yeah, I saw that you were doing on Washington State. I was like, definitely going to chat with you about that. Have you been out here to Washington State?
No, I haven't. I have never been out there.
Well, maybe
I actually really wanted to go out there at some point and do an investigation up in British Columbia, but we'll just have to see when I got the time. I got so much going on now. It's kind of hard for me to even get boots on the ground for myself.
Yeah.
If I get somebody, and I do have investigators in the area, if I do need somebody to go to a specific area, I can usually get somebody to do it.
Yeah.
So that's the advantage of having the group itself.
Yeah, my paranormal team is part of the TAPS family team, so we get a lot of stuff from there, and that's kind of fun to be able to part of a group and share information, that kind of stuff. So, do you have any stories that you know of from Oregon that you're going to report on, or are you not there yet?
Offhand, it's pretty similar to what you get down in Washington, D.C. It's a lot of Bigfoot. You got a lot of stuff really near the Northern California border going into Oregon. So, there's a lot of reports. I mean, it's mostly Bigfoot, but we had a variety of them. The Glimmer Man reports, the winged humanoid reports. I don't know of any cryptid canines. But we do UFO stuff, and there's a lot of UFO activity and abduction activity in Pacific Northwest. So I kind of mix a little bit here and there with it.
So what is your view on the current UFO disclosure recently dumped by the Trump administration? Do you have a take on that, or do you think it's more just of another big distraction?
Well, I think it's exactly that. I don't think they're going to tell us anything that really needs to be told. Most of what we know now is declassified anyway. Yeah. We're kind of being spoon-fed. We get bits and pieces, and to keep Congress happy and other people who have been part of this whole disclosure thing, to keep them quiet. I just don't think there's much going to be said unless it absolutely has to be said. I mean, if a craft lands on the White House lawn, then we're going to have to need to know. But beyond that, I don't think they're going to say much of anything. Sure, they're going to talk. They may talk about lights in the sky and other things, but when it comes to other beings or non-human intelligences and such, and what the whole story is behind that and how much of that has actually become part of our lives over the years. I don't think we're going to hear much about that.
No, probably not more than we already know. I mean, they're just going to give us more rumors and whatnot. And do you find that, do you get reports of UFOs coming out of the ocean?
Occasionally. Yeah, occasionally. We got certain areas where it's more prevalent, of course, off the coast of Southern California, Santa Barbara, and those areas, that seems to be a hot spot. Of course, in the Gulf as well, always a lot of rumors of underwater bases and such, and, stuff that may just be in the movies, but people believe it. And, we do get a lot of underwater or submerged craft sightings. Some official sightings that get leaked out were, say, a Coast Guard cutter would have seen something that could have been a craft underwater and such. Those things pop up occasionally.
I saw a report locally about Mount Adams. I saw some pictures. I don't know if they're legit or anything like that, but they're saying that they saw a door opening on Mount Adams in these crafts going in and out of that. So.
Yeah, I got a few woo friends that are really into the whole Mount Shasta, Mount Adams, and all that culture itself. Some fairly well-known ufologists as well. So, yeah, I've heard a lot of that. Is it true? Yeah, maybe it could be. I don't know. Those two mountains have had a lot of a lot of press and a lot of speculation over the years. We really, other than seeing lights, we really don't know what's going on there. Now, of course, people talk about, the Sasquatch activity picks up and a lot of paranormal activity that's usually doesn't happen, but kind of ramps up at certain periods of time when the lights are on the mountains and such.
Yeah.
There may be a connection there, but until we get more evidence, and you know, I can't really go deeper into that other than I'm not going to speculate about it.
I like to go up there and hang out in the woods and look for things that I can't explain. I haven't had too many explanations there, unexplained things in that area, but I mean, I wouldn't know what I was looking at if I found it. So it's probably a good thing I haven't. I want to have that Sasquatch experience, but something tells me if you go looking for it, you're not going to find it. It's when you're not looking is when you're going to get it.
And that's usually the case. When I had mine back in 1981, I wasn't looking for anything. I was just out there fly fishing on a river, and it showed up. And you know, I was as surprised as anybody. I thought when it happened, they may have been a Sasquatch or a Bigfoot, but I had no idea. Because honestly, in my case, it looked more human than it did any type of primate or ape. So even though it was standing about 7 or 7.5, 8 foot tall, and it was hair all over it, it's that face itself still sticks with me, like the Neanderthal look that people would, you know, that you would see in the books of a Neanderthal. That's what stood out to me more than anything.
What's your take on the Patterson-Gimlin film?
I think it's real. I still think it's real. I mean, there's a lot of people trying to debunk it, and they have been ever since it came out. But the people involved and other investigators that I know who are very interested in it and who have an open mind about the whole situation, I still believe it's something that actually occurred.
That's my take on it, too. I mean, the video's been out for so long. If it was fake, somebody had been able to prove it by now.
Yeah, I think the technology back then did not lend to it being faked. It would have been more amateur-like. And, you know, when you do take a look at Patty itself and try to look at the muscle tone, the way it walks and the way it reacts and such, it's pretty hard to dispute it. Sure, yeah. People are going to have preset notions about what this thing is and that, you know, people are seeing something other than that, or they're just imagining it. And you get all kinds of excuses. But yeah. I think the evidence itself is worthy enough to put it on that the true side.
Yeah. I'd have to, especially when you're watching the video and it has breasts.
Yes. Yes.
Like they wouldn't have, like if they were trying to hoax it, that's not something they would have wasted time on.
Absolutely not.
That's when I first noticed that, I was watching a show and they pointed it out and I was like, wow. Cause I mean, like they really, I mean, who's going to waste time on, oh, let's make it out breath. They're just not going to do that. Especially back then.
Well, the one thing that convinces me more than anything, and a lot of people don't talk about this, but you know, when you look at the film and you look when Patty kind of looks back toward the camera, there's a lot of loose skin around that belly area.
Yeah.
And I think she had an infant very early. I mean, very close to the time this was taken. And it seems like there's a lot of stretched out skin there. And but it does move like it normally would if that was the case. So, I think there's enough there to kind of go on the yes column with this. And I haven't really seen much of anything that disputes that or can convince me otherwise.
Yeah. Have you had any experience that you were talking about your experiences at Gettysburg? Do you do a lot of paranormal investigations when it comes to like ghost activity?
I did. I do occasionally if somebody contacts me. Especially locally, I will go out and do what I can and see if we can help kind of change the mood or change some of the activity that's going on. I have been doing that for a long time, and my abilities kind of tend to help me with that. And we've had some success over the years, but I've usually worked either by myself or with a team of people who are have psychic abilities and intuitive abilities, and you know, aren't going to let any type of activity get to their head. They're going to be very forthright about it, and you know, we try to tell the people what we believe. The one thing I do in particular is when there's a family situation and there's children involved,
yeah,
and it's starting to cause issues with them, I will normally take them under my wing if I get permission from parents to do so, and try to explain to them. Because if I'm involved with a case and a child's case comes up, where, I mean, where children are involved with it, I will definitely go. That goes to the top of the list, and that's something I've primarily focused on over the years.
Do you get people that try to fool you, hoax you, that kind of thing?
Occasionally,
yeah, we've
it
run out a
happens.
few times, but it's not fun when they do, because people don't realize how serious we take this kind of thing, and this is, you know, this, you know, and they also don't realize it's not our first day either. So
yeah.
fooling us is not going to be as easy as they think it is.
Well, I'll tell you, there seems to be less of it now than there ever has been. You know, I would do this years ago, and you always get some joker who wants to try to pull the wool over your eyes, but. Honestly, I don't think I've had a case. Now, I don't do as many as I used to, but I don't think I've had a case where somebody tried to hoax me for at least 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
And I've probably done about 25 or 30 in that period of time. So I found what I thought was substantial evidence and using my abilities. And I mean, we use a little bit of electronics, but not that much. And I usually have people with me who know what they're doing. And, yeah, we can usually figure out what's going on.
Yeah. My team, we go in and we try to find logical explanations. And sometimes we can't. Well, most of the time we can.
Yeah.
And a lot of time what it is people watch too much paranormal TV.
Well, you know, that's true. And yeah. Honestly, some of the cases, I mean, even – I'd say about starting 20 years ago when paranormal TV became very prevalent.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to be a paranormal investigator. And we'd have people going out to cemeteries and places, haunted areas, and they wouldn't protect themselves. They get that attitude that they're going to try to force one of these things to show themselves or to manifest. And I have had so many people who thought they were investigators who got attachments to them. And that happens a lot. It had happened a lot. But yeah, that's, you know, you sit down and talk to them and tell them and you figure out what they did wrong or what they continued to do.
Yeah.
And honestly, if they're determined to continue on that way and they don't believe what I'm saying, I just won't work with them.
Yeah, that's kind of where we're at. For us, we never had an issue with like a team member having something like that, thankfully, because I think it's all about going in respectfully. Really.
Oh, yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, you know, people may think that that's crazy, but these are energies.
Yeah.
These are being our energies or even beings. It's in some points where they lived among the living and they have. Yeah. They have emotions too, and many times these energies don't even know they're dead.
Yeah,
and they're trying to get people's attention, and that attention is a haunting. And basically, the living don't understand that, and they start looking for help, and that's where we come in. But yeah, it's there's a lot of facets to it, but. You know, I think we've done pretty well over the years. And as we continue to move forward and train new people and such, I don't know how much more the actual investigations I'm going to do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of other stuff I would like to start getting involved with, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
Never know what's going to come up.
So if people want to find out more information about you and buy your books and that kind of thing, or report a sighting or whatever, how do they get a hold of you?
Well, they just go to their website, phantomsandmonsters.com, spelled out. And we have a report link there, and they can I've got a contact with my phone number and my email and everything to get a hold of me. They can call me anytime. You know, I will do what I can to do it. My books are all on the books that are still in print are all on Amazon. Okay. Just search Lon Strickler and it'll come up.
All right. Well, it's been great having you. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
The Columbian and Southwest Washington continues to offer the most comprehensive and consistent coverage of our region and our people, despite the challenges faced by local newspapers nationwide. Valued donations to our community-funded journalism project via the Local Media Foundation, pays for local reporters to provide expanded and in-depth coverage of key local issues in print and online, including homelessness, transportation, and the environment. For the most thorough daily coverage, visit Columbian.com. Please consider donating or subscribing today.
Shriners Children's has opened a new pediatric orthopedic clinic in Vancouver. The clinic offers evaluation and follow-up care for children and teens with orthopedic conditions, including sports-related injuries. Care is available regardless of a family's ability to pay. Details about the Vancouver clinic are at shrinerschildrens.org/Vancouver Clinic.
Support for KXRW Vancouver comes from On Point Removal Services. On Point Removal Services is a Vancouver, Washington-based junk removal service that proudly serves all of the Clark County area and beyond. Offering residential, office, and construction junk removal, On Point will do all of the loading, pickup, hauling, and cleanup on your project. And On Point is fully licensed and insured. For more information, visit their website at onpoint-removal.com.
You better work.
Discover our city's hidden gem, hiding right below the sidewalk. Underbar is a speakeasy-themed cocktail lounge located downtown Vancouver. As an LGBTQ-friendly and gay-owned space, it is a go-to destination for weekly events such as comedy, trivia, bingo, and open mic nights. Local artists are featured every first Friday of the month, and every fourth Sunday is Underbar's Underground Drag Brunch Show, 2 to 4 p.m. More information and location can be found at underbarvancouver.com. That's underbarvancouver.com.
Hey, this is Ricky Rocket from Poison, and you're listening to Hassling the Paranormal on KXRW 99.9 FM.
The Columbian calls singer-songwriter Al Perez a soulful performer masterfully woven, whether he's on his acoustic guitar solo or backed by his five-member live band. Al Perez has thrilled local and abroad audiences for over two decades with his unique blend of light rock, R&B, fan-favorite covers, and a touch of Latin flavor. To book Al Perez or hear his latest Warrior Records release, Love Revolution, go to warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez. That's warriorrecords.com/Al-Perez.
We could be like Bonnie and Clyde, ride or die, baby. I'll be a Peter Pan man, you be Tinkerbell, baby. Story left to be told. Baby, get it right.
KXRW programming is made possible by partners like Buckley & Associates, attorneys at law, helping injured victims seek the justice they deserve for over 40 years, licensed in Washington State. Our diverse team speaks over 7 languages, making your rights more accessible and easier to understand. Learn more at BuckleyLaw.net. Again, that's BuckleyLaw.net. Buckley & Associates. We speak your language.
The Community Angels at National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, or NWCAVE, have a dream, a world without violence. NWCAVE educates about the prevention of violence against women and children. Learn more at nwcave.org.